Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to Art for doing Rock of Ages. I asked him beforehand if he took requests. Maybe I shouldn't say that because now everybody will be requesting things. I appreciate that. That has nothing to do with the lesson this morning. It's just I needed some reinforcement. And I also like to thank Zach for his reading that he hasn't done yet. But he's a remarkable young man, and I know he's going to do a wonderful job because he always does. And I'm really proud of him, and I'm proud of Mark and Tandy for the job they're doing all of their kids. I asked Mark about once how he did that, and he said they just beat him a lot, but I don't think that's true. Hopefully the lesson will be very quick this morning. It's a very simple lesson, and I didn't want to pollute it with too many words. But if I do cut it short, Trudy told me beforehand she's got a roast in the oven, and if she goes like this, I'm to cut it off immediately. So if I just stop in mid-sentence, that's why. You wouldn't miss a thing if I do. Anyway, you've all probably been hurt at some point in your life. And the person that hurt you probably had been hurt too. And every hurt we endure, we're faced with a choice. We can choose to either get all bent out of shape, or we can allow our response to be shaped by grace. Bitterness clouds our vision, and it blinds us to grace. But grace is not blind, and it sees our hurt full well. And grace also sees God's forgiveness, even when we can't even conceive of it. Christian author Max Lucado once said, if hurts were hairs, we'd all be grizzlies. And I suppose that's probably true. The smooth-skinned beauties on the magazine covers, to the calm and collected gospel preacher, the little old lady next door, to every person in this room this morning, we're all hairy beasts. Because life is full of hurts. When kids at school make fun of you, when teachers ignore your work, when your bosses think you're doing a lousy job, oh, you're the best producer in the whole team, it hurts. It just plain hurts. Rejection always hurts. And so as summer brings the sun, so life brings hurt. It's just part of life. I heard a story several years ago on Paul Harvey that has stuck with me all of these years. I don't know if it's because it reminds me of Jeanette or if it's just the fact that Paul Harvey had a way of relaying information that tended to stick with you for a long time. But he told a story of a 44-year-old woman named Victoria Rugolo. And she was driving home one November evening in 2004 on her way to her home in Manhattan. And she had just attended her niece's piano recital. And she was excited about spending a nice quiet home. She'd already envisioned sitting in front of the fire, reading a book, and listening to music. And I probably don't even need to finish the story, do I? You probably know where this is heading. She never saw the car coming towards her. She doesn't even remember it. And she doesn't remember the 18-year-old boy leaning out the window and throwing into her windshield, of all things, a frozen turkey. And that turkey, that 20-pound bird, crashed through the windshield, smashed the steering wheel into her face, and she spent the next 3 weeks in intensive care. The doctors were able to save her only because they were able to wire her jaw back together. They used synthetic film to save her eye, and they bolted titanium plates to her skull. Otherwise, she would never have lasted. She can't look in a mirror for the rest of her life without seeing a reminder of her hurt. Now, chances are none of you were hit by a turkey, but maybe, like my wife, you married one, or maybe you work for one, maybe you have one that lives next door. But the one thing I know for sure is that you've all been hurt, and you've all been hurt deeply, and most sadly of all, it's probably happened more than once. Because if hurts were hares, we'd all be grizzlies. So the question is not so much, are we going to get hurt, but what do we do with our hurts? And that's what I'd like to talk to this morning. One of my favorite preachers that I've listened to every day for probably 20 years is a guy named Charles Swindoll. And he once said, life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. And in the world today, aren't we just taught the exact opposite of that? And it's just not right. There's another great story that it's a story about a soldier in Afghanistan, and I hope it's a true story because it's a great one. It's short, so I'll tell it for the sake of the one or two that might not have heard it before. There was a soldier serving in Afghanistan. He'd been over there for a year, and he was homesick. He was tired. He missed his girlfriend, his fiance. And one day, he got the infamous and dreaded Dear John letter. And his fiance said, the wedding's off. And furthermore, she requested that he send back to her the picture he had of her so she could use it in her next engagement announcement. Well, his buddies were incensed by this, as you can well imagine, and so one of them had a great idea. So all the buddies scoured the base, and they got girlfriend pictures from every soldier on base. And they put them in a big shoebox. And this jilted soldier wrote a note to put in with them, and it said this, I accept the breakup, and I'm returning your picture as you requested, but you will have to pick it out from all the others because for the life of me, I can't remember what you look like. Well, retaliation sure has its points. Revenge can feel awfully good. But there's always that side of us that wants to get even just for the hurt. But Jesus had a better idea. And it's talked about in the Gospel of John, chapter 13. If you'd like to, you can turn there. In John chapter 13, this takes place the night before the crucifixion. He and his followers have gathered in the upper room to partake of the Passover meal. And John begins his narrative of the events with a very lofty statement. Let's start reading in verse 3 of chapter 13. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. Now let's pause there for a moment. Jesus knew the who and why of his life. He knew who he was and he knew why he was there. He knew that he came from God and would return to God. There is no question as to who he was. He knew his identity and knew his purpose. And he knew that God had given him all authority to do whatever he chose. And what did he do with that authority? Well, let's pick up in verse 4. Verse 4 of John 13 says, so he got up from the table, took off his robe, wrapped a towel around his waist. He poured water into a basin. Then he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel he had around his waist. Jesus, identifying himself as God, the creator of the entire universe, he could do anything he wanted to do. And what did he do? He decided to wash some feet. Now let me interject at this point. I personally am not a fan of feet. Feet are dirty and smelly, and I think it's for a reason we keep them covered up with shoes and socks. Some people may like feet. I don't. I love my wife dearly, madly, passionately, but I carry a picture of her feet in my wallet. It's just something we don't do. If you want me to shake your hand, I'd be honored to do so. You want a hug? Sure. Want a pat on the back? You deserve it. I'll give it, but please don't ask me to wash your feet. Feet are dirty. Feet are smelly. And I kind of think that's the point of the whole story here in John 13. Back in biblical times, of course, the washing of feet was just a way of life. That's something they did routinely. They didn't think twice about it. They just did it. Today, it couldn't be much more foreign to us. We come sort of close to it when we take our shoes off at the door when we visit somebody, but they don't wash our feet. I remember many years ago when I worked for IBM, I had to go to an apartment of a young Japanese married couple. I think they were married. They fought like they were married. Anyway, I had to take my shoes and my socks off outside the apartment before I even walked in. But they didn't wash my feet. We just don't do that anymore. And of all the body parts that Jesus could have cleansed, he chose the feet, the dirty, smelly, ugly feet. And remember, this was the job of the lowest servant on the totem pole in the household. The lowest servant on the totem pole was the one that got the duty to wash people's feet. And everybody that came over got their feet washed. Could have been the head of the household when he, after a long day in the fields or at the office or camel jockeying, whatever. It could have been visitors. Visitors wanted to be shown that they were welcome, and so they would wash their feet. They didn't, after all, take showers like we do today. They didn't have showers, so they washed their feet. But on this day, when Jesus and his disciples entered the upper room, the basin was there and the towel was there, but the servant was not. Well, actually, the servant was there. His name was of Nazareth. And I'm sure the disciples must have seen the basin there. They must have seen the towel. But not one of them thought anything other than someone should be about the business of washing our feet. It never occurred to them to pick up the basin and the towel themselves. But they didn't have to, did they? Because Jesus did. And again, Jesus, knowing that he has all authority, what did he use his authority to do? To boss people around? To order people to straighten up? To tell them that they better get their act together? To order one of them to take the basin and wash the feet? No, he humbled himself. He got down to the lowest parts of the upper room and washed the lowest parts of the disciples' body. I bet you could have heard a pin drop in that room. I bet the disciples must have been flabbergasted that the master, the creator of everything, would have gotten down on the floor and washed everybody's feet. And furthermore, if you'll notice in this passage that he doesn't pass up anybody. He washes everybody's feet. Nowhere in chapter 13 or anywhere else will you read that Jesus washed everybody's feet but Philip. And if you recall, Philip was the one that Jesus told to feed the 5,000 with just a couple of crumbs of bread and some fish. And what did Philip say? Oh, Lord, that's impossible. So what does Jesus do with people that question his direct orders? He washes their feet. Then there was James and John. James and John, you will remember, tried to use their relationship with Christ to jockey for cabinet-level positions in the new kingdom. So what does Jesus do with people that use their relationship with Christ for personal gain? Well, he washes their feet. And then what about Peter? He not only tried to talk us out of going to the cross, but just in a few short hours, he would deny that he had ever even met the man. And what does Jesus do with promise breakers? He washes their feet. And what about Judas? If anybody could have been passed over, surely it could have been Judas, that lying, conniving thief who in just a couple of hours would commit the single largest act of betrayal in human history. A man whose very name has become synonymous with betrayal. He sells out God, our Savior, for 30 lousy, stinking pieces of silver. Jesus isn't going to wash his feet, is he? Surely not. Jesus isn't going to take the basin and slide it over in front of him and put his feet in the basin and wash them, is he? Probably not. At least we hope not, right? Because if Jesus is going to wash the feet of his Jesus, then we have to wash the feet, of Judas. Then we have to wash the feet of our Judas. And we don't want to do that. We'd rather stew in that cauldron of hatred and animosity that we've prepared in advance. We would rather let the Vesuvius of anger that wells up within us spew hatred and anger and spite in the world, and pollute our day with bitterness and revenge. But most people would not purposely draw close to their Judas. But listen up. You're not most people. You are a grace-bent people. You are a people chosen by God. And something wonderful has happened to you. In fact, it's happening at this very moment. Your feet are getting wet. Jesus is washing your feet. The Son of God, knowing where he came from, knowing where he was returning to, knowing all the sum of human history, having created everything in the universe, and he can do anything he chooses, and he chooses to serve you. And most of all, he's forgiven us of all of our mistakes. That's no small thing. He has cleansed us. He has placed our feet in the basin. He has washed them. He has taken the dirtiest, grimiest parts of our lives. He has taken all of our sins, yours and mine, all of our rebellion, all of our failures, and he hasn't passed up any one of us. He has washed all of our feet. And then, after washing our feet, he's looked up at us and says in verse 14 and 15 of John 13, "Since I, the Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you ought to wash the other's feet. I have given you an example to follow. Do as I have done for you." In other words, now go out and do it. To accept grace is to accept the vow to give grace. Since Jesus has forgiven us, we're going to turn and in turn forgive other people. And that's what Victoria Rugolo did. Remember the lady I told you about a few minutes ago? 9 months after her terrible night, she was in court. Her scars still fresh and pink. And so was the young 18-year-old man. But he wasn't the cocky 18-year-old that he was 9 months earlier. He was trembling. He was frightened. And most of all, he was sorry. He was truly repentant. And he was in a packed courtroom because he had become, this 18-year-old kid, had become in New York a poster child for everything that was wrong with the current generation. And the courtroom was packed with people wanting to make sure that justice was done. In fact, if they could have been in charge of meeting out the justice, they would have gladly done so right then and there on the spot, and the kid probably wouldn't have survived. But that crowd erupted in anger, and a riot ensued when the judge announced his sentence. 6 months behind bars, 5 years of probation, and community service. And everybody was livid over that. They could not believe that this kid was getting off so light. Everybody was livid except for Victoria Rugolo, because she was the one that talked to the judge and talked him into treating the kid with kindness and grace. And in that crowded courtroom, in front of everybody for all eyes to see, she got up from her seat and she walked over to the 18-year-old kid. She put her arms around him and held him close. And she said, "I forgive you, and I want your life to be the best that it can be." She allowed grace to shape her response, and she washed his feet. Later on in an interview, she said, "God gave me a second chance at life, and I passed it on to him. If I hadn't let go of that anger, I would have been consumed by the need for revenge. Forgiving helped me to move on." So what about you? Yes, we're all like grizzlies. And some of us are angry. Some of us are bitter. And no one questions whether we have a right or not to get even. But it's a pretty good question to ask, does getting even do us any good? You see, you could build a prison of hate if you want. You can. You could build a prison of anger and bitterness, and you can move in. But I'm here to tell you, create your cell with just one bunk, because nobody else is going to want to live there with you. Go ahead and put 50-inch flat-screen TVs on every wall. You can rehearse and relive every single unkind thing that's been done to you. every hurt that you've endured, you can go over and over until you die. And you can allow that prison to define you. You can allow Jesus to refine you. You can give the grace that you've been given. When you forgive somebody, you're not saying that what they did was right. You're not endorsing their behavior. You're not pretending that what they did to you was acceptable. No, it was wrong. It was darn wrong. And I know there are people in this room this morning that have been used and abused over and over and over again. And sometimes you just want to get even. But here's what God has to say about that. He says, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay." Vengeance is not ours. It belongs to Him. This is something I've struggled with for a long time, and I hope this isn't too controversial for you all, but we all hear this thing called forget. When you forgive someone their trespasses, you're not condoning what they did. You're saying it never happened in the first place. That's why I think forgiveness is so hard. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. Why isn't it ours? Well, we never know how much to give. We'll always give too much or too little. Because only God is truly just. And also, when you forgive somebody, you're saying that you're not going to allow your past to define your future. And you're going to live your life as one whose heart has been softened by the grace of God. You are trusting the Lord to take care of it. And to take care of the person that hurt you and sort everything out. Forgiveness takes all of our hurts and all of our pains and places them at the foot of the cross of Christ. And so we must all understand, not just accept, but understand that Jesus loved our enemies so much that He died for them. And so if He can forgive them, then who are we to deny them? And I know grace, giving grace is a process. There's a do it once and then you're done sort of thing. It takes time. It's part of the growth process of being a Christian. I think as long as we're trying, as long as we're marching toward forgiveness, as long as we're opening our hearts and asking Jesus to help us forgive, I think you'll find this. Jesus will come and He will set you free from your hatred. I promise. I know it because I've been through it. And it does happen. Just like He did for Victoria Rugolo. And just like He did for a community of Amish in Pennsylvania. Several years ago, you probably remember this, October 2nd, 2006, a young man full of hatred entered into an Amish grade school in Pennsylvania, called the Western Hills Amish Grade School, with less than honorable intentions, I might add. Here's a few of the things he took with him on that morning: a 9mm handgun, a 12-gauge shotgun, a rifle, a bag of black powder, two knives, tools, a stun gun, 600 rounds of ammunition, wire, and plastic ties. There were several other items that he took in with him as well that I don't think are even appropriate to mention in this setting. But let's say he was not there to make friends. So, as he lined all the girls up, there was 11 of them, ages 6 through 16, and prepared to shoot them. The first one stood up and said, "Please kill me first." And then her little sister said, "Please kill me next." Three of the girls died immediately. The rest died in hospital over the course of the next week. The murderer killed himself. It was a crime that shocked the nation. But what was even more stunning was the outpouring of grace afterwards. The Amish rallied around the family of the murderer and extended love, extended grace. More than half of the people that attended the young man's funeral were direct family members of the murdered girls. The midwife that had delivered all of the girls herself formed a brigade of people that would make sure there was food supplied for the murderer's family. Just stunning And in an interview later on, a reporter asked, how could she possibly have done that for these people? She said, it is possible if you have Christ in your heart. I think you'd agree with me when I say that our country needs a good, healthy dose of forgiveness. We live in a day of danger, bitterness, and rage. We are so polarized, whether it be politically, spiritually, socially, sexually. We live in an angry society, and I believe, though, that in the midst of this angry society, there is a group of God-created people who are practicing grace. And that can make all the difference in the world. People that realize that Jesus has washed their sins and washed their feet, and now we need to be about the business of washing other people's feet. Sequence matters in this process, of course. We first allowed Jesus to wash our feet, and now we wash the feet of others. You don't have to be a converted Christian to enjoy grace. The lost receive grace every day. But grace alone is not enough to get you to heaven. Mark 16:16 says it pretty clearly. Those who believe and are baptized will be saved. Those who do not believe will not be saved. It's still God's grace that gets us there. But just simply believing is not going to be enough to put you over the edge. There's no middle ground here. There's no gray area. There's no room for interpretation. And this is where the world goes wrong. You're either saved or you're not. And so this morning I have a question for you. If you're here and you have not accepted the plea of Christ to come to Him, I have one question. Why not? What possibly could you be waiting on? If you need an engraved invitation, we have one. We have one we can give you. It's called the Bible. And He's pleading with you this morning to come. If you're here and you're a member of the church, but you've not yet, or you've fallen away, you've committed some unrepented sins, you need the prayers of the congregation, whatever, come forward, wash your feet. If we could be of any help at all, we're happy to do so. Trust me. No, wait a minute. Trust Him. Trust Him. So, that's it. If you need anything at all from us, please come forward now as we stand and as we sing. Jesus is standing in Pilate's.